The official Vintage Guitar Magazine 2025 price guide has partnered with 33 of the top guitar dealers in the industry to provide the most accurate values for thousands of models. This includes electric guitars, acoustic guitars, basses, amplifiers, effects, mandolins, and banjos. Whether your instrument is an investment or simply a piece you enjoy playing, it's always helpful to know what it's worth. If you're checking out a guitar at your local shop and want to know its value before making the purchase, this guide is your go-to source for all the details. Available in both print and digital editions, you can have the guide right at your fingertips no matter where you go.
Hello, and welcome to Buy That Guitar, presented by Vintage Guitar Magazine. I'm your host, Ram Tooley. This podcast is about the joy of guitar. That includes buying guitars, selling guitars, collecting guitars. We're talking vintage guitars, new guitars, used guitars, pre-war, flat tops, electric Spanish arch tops, custom shop guitars, limited edition guitars, basses, amps, effect pedals, lap steels, mandolins, banjo. If it has strings, we're going to talk about it. I spend most of my life studying the vintage guitar market. It's truly something I love and I'm passionate about. I can talk guitars all day, and I'm going to. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another thrilling and exciting edition of Buy That Guitar.
Tony,
today I'm with Tony Nagy, manager of the Grooms Repair Shop. Tony is recognized for his meticulous craftsmanship and his ability to handle complex repairs that preserve and enhance any instrument's value and playability. Now, that doesn't mean if it could be a 70s Guild or a pre-war D45. How are you today, Tony?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me on.
We should let everybody know you're working, but you did take a little time. Are they going to come in and bother you as we're talking?
Oh, I'm working. Chances are they won't, but there's no guarantees.
Well, you're a very important person, and I've been wanting to do this particular podcast for a long time. We've talked for a long time,
yeah.
And we were both agreeing that there's a lot of misconceptions out there. There's a lot of things like everybody wants to collect vintage guitars, but nobody knows how to maintain them. And isn't that like probably the most important thing about owning a guitar collection is knowing how to maintain them?
If you're going to do that as a serious endeavor, of course, you're going to have pretty deep knowledge. I mean, we see instruments come in here in various states of proper maintenance and some that are just beautiful, pristine, properly stored instruments and some not so much. And it really does affect the value once you get into collectible land. Condition is everything. I mean, every I have to go through a checklist on each instrument we check in, and every single thing that's been adjusted, broken, is not in the condition it needs to be, is just ends up in the negative column, you know. And so I think understanding this is a pretty much a primary importance.
One of the things I think you guys are so busy there. It's very hard for somebody to bring something to you to be fixed. It's really stuff that comes into the shop on consignment or to be sold that you have to look at first, right? Is that where most of your work is?
Well, for the most part, yeah. Now, if somebody buys an instrument here, then we will always, if there's an issue or something you need done, we will figure out a way to get you taken care of as a or a customer service sort of thing. But yeah, sometimes it is difficult. Sometimes the shop is just us fixing the things we're going to consign and the things that we've purchased.
So everybody knows Groon's guitars. If you're a vintage guitar collector, everybody knows George Groon,
right?
Knows Groon's guitars. How long have you been managing the repair shop at Groon's?
Now I've just been managing. I have followed Greg Boros, who was managing the repair shop for quite a while, and through COVID,
mm-hmm.
And at the end of COVID, Greg has a much more expanded role as far as the business is concerned, and I manage the repair shop. It's really just means of keeping track, because each guy kind of manages his own little mini repair shop. You know, you have your collection of projects that you do, and
mm-hmm.
and time frames to get them done in. And I just keep track of flow and making sure everybody has the supplies they need and interacting with consigners and customers as we have to. And, just trying to keep, it's a lot. It's a lot of guitars.
And is Lynn Carlson and Corey Terrell still there?
Yeah. Yeah. Those guys are.
This was a no brainer. Cause as far as, when it comes to repair shops and stuff, Groon's is always listed as one of the best. And people are willing to buy a Grunes just because they know that what they're getting is what they're supposed to be getting, you know?
I tell you, I don't think people sometimes understand how we pour over instruments up here to make sure we know what we're looking at, because as much a cumulative experience as there is in the building, I mean, because even though, you know, so many guys that I have not been to shop, you know, the shop turns over some and the older guys go and do their thing, but it's a cumulative information experience, meaning that, you know, each guy that came before you passed something on, who passed something on. And so I am the benefit of basically the knowledge of not just the repair and restoration, but the actual physical knowledge of guitars.
Right.
Along with George's immense knowledge, you know, I'm here at the apex of that sort of information. And so we have no choice but to get it right.
Right. You know, when I was a kid, I remember, you know, you used to get those books in the Scholastic book service at the back. There was this book, it was called How to Care for Your Monster. And I remember all of us were really into this thing. And it was like, you know, remember it's like the kids walking down the stairs with a bowl of bolts. And there's like this Frankenstein hiding in the basement. Man, I wish when I was in my teens that I had a book called How to Care for Your Vintage Guitar.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, back then, too, the deal was, you know, they weren't as big a deal when we were younger. I mean, that's the other thing to understand as we come in contact with these things. We you know, especially since they're expensive commodities, they seem so much more precious to us now. And remember, back in the day, it was just the guitar.
Right, right.
And people treated them as such, including some of the unfortunate mods they did to them. And just the care, it's just like, yeah, Dad took this guitar to Vietnam.
Right.
You know, because it was a guitar and he needed one.
Right.
You know, or whatever was going on, you know, it stayed in the garage because nobody was playing it. Because it was just the guitar.
So we're gonna talk about, like, we're basically gonna kind of put together now a book, a presentation of how do you care for your vintage guitar, and this means just understanding what needs to be done to maintain a 60 to 70 to almost 100 year old guitar sometimes, and vintage guitars and electric solid bodies are completely different animals. Correct?
That is correct. However, the principles all still apply. It's just in varying degrees. You know, you still have a solid body instrument, still an instrument made out of wood with, you know, similar finishes on it. It just doesn't move as much and it isn't quite as prone to the damage of humidity and temperature extremes as an acoustic. But that's not to say that it isn't affected adversely by being dry or, you know, humid or cold or hot. You know, you'll create extra finish checking and all of the things that could happen, you know, in temperature and humidity extremes. It's just not quite as delicate.
Is humidity your greatest asset and your greatest enemy when you're keeping vintage guitars?
Well, you know what? It really is the two-edged swords of the temperature and humidity. You know, often, especially, well, in temperate regions, you know, humidity and temperature kind of ride together, being that usually the hotter it is, the more humid it is, and the colder it is, the drier it is. That doesn't hold true out west, as we all know. You know, it can be hot and dry. So I would say if we started with humidity, trying to keep that within that range around 50%, that is the best place to start. And then temperature is just way more obvious. You know, there's so many things that we are cognizant of not keeping, you know, of keeping out of the heat and out of the cold. That's a little easier one to focus on. But I think, I mean, we get sent guitars all the time from out west, and they are just bone dry. I mean, they've almost collapsed on themselves. They're so dry.
Mm-hmm.
And just people just don't, because you can't see it. You can't feel it so much. You're just not as aware of the effect it's having on your instruments, because it's not readily feelable, you know.
Right. So let's start with the vintage guitars. The vintage acoustic guitars. And this is kind of like where when I think of Grunes, I really think of the vintage guitars. So how many guitars do you see that need neck resets?
I would tell you that if we just talk about golden era Martin guitars, just singularly, it's at least three quarters of them, if not more.
Is there any shame in having a neck reset?
You know, at this point, actually, a neck reset, actually, we call it the trifecta. Almost nearly every one of the instruments we need, for, you know, that is in the realm of, you know, 60 to 80 years old, they need a neck reset, a refret, and a bridge re-glue.
Okay.
That's basically the start. And we, at this point, those things are considered maintenance. They really are. I mean, you know, even like a lot of those instruments, you know, iconic electric guitars from the 50s and 60s, if somebody says, well, original frets, you know what? People that play guitars, it means so much less to them.
Right.
You know, everybody wants playable instruments. And so a refret, a neck reset, and a bridge re-glue are considered maintenance.
So no longer do you take off exceptional value based on the fact that it's been refretted or rebridged, or a bridge has been worked on, or that it's, the neck has been reset, that there's no longer a 20% penalty.
Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, most collectors will ask as part of the description, if they know it's a 40 whatever, they'll say, is the neck being reset? Meaning, I hope so I can play.
Right. There's one other thing, like I mentioned earlier that I didn't know how to maintain my vintage guitars. I had a Telecaster, a 52 Telecaster, that needed a fret job, but I refused to refret it because I didn't want to take value away from it. And I remember my friend Harvey Moltz told me, like, well, do you play it? I'm like, yeah, I play it all the time. And he said, then refret it. What is good about a guitar that you can't play very well? You know, it made all the difference. And once I refretted that 52 Telecaster, I wasn't afraid to refret the other ones. And so all of a sudden it was like, I would say half my instruments have been refretted now. And that's just so I can play them. There's, to me, the penalty is no longer that, you know, there's no penalty, you know, so that, to me, that's refret the thing, you know, refret it.
Now, the only caveat I would add to that, and I believe that wholeheartedly as well, is that for it to be professionally done in a manner that does keep the value. So, you know, some of those 50s maple fingerboard instruments, Fenders, you know, if you're being able to keep that patina that's on there, you know, for the things that, and doing your best to get away with doing a refret without touching the fingerboard any. Things like that, that are a little higher order restoration things, are things to consider, mm-hmm. you know, and you know, when we say, when I don't want to flippantly say, you know, yeah, you know, a neck set is considered maintenance. A neck set is a very serious operation.
Right.
You know, I don't want it to seem like it's less than it is just because it's maintenance, because there are way more ways to do it wrong than there are to do it right.
We'll get back into, I think we'll talk about refretting when we get into the solid bodies more.
Yeah.
The neck reset to me is like the most, is probably the most important thing for a 80, 90 year old Martin. And I think that comparing Martins and Gibsons, which ones need the most neck resets?
It's all over the place. I mean, I never think of it that way because it doesn't matter, because just whatever I'm looking at either needs one or doesn't. But I would say that, every once in a while we get some Gibsons just because of there's a difference in structure, the way they're put together and the wider heels. Every once in a while we get those in and they don't need that kind of thing. Most Martins, I'd have to say most Martins just really do. And it's not anything other than they stay strung up and played because they're just wonderful instruments.
Do you have to shave wood off of a neck when you reset it?
Yes. Usually you're taking some material off the inside of the heel so that it kicks the angle of the neck back, which in turn draws the strings closer to the fingerboard, which is what we're shooting for then, just to get the correct angle so that the instrument's at its most playable.
And as far as you're concerned, like the neck reset, when you bring a guitar, like somebody brings in a guitar to sell at Grunes,
yes,
and you immediately, you check the neck, and if it needs a reset, you do it right then and there, right?
Yeah, well, what we'll do, we'll assess it that it does need a neck reset. And then however we disposition that instrument as either a consignment or if we purchase it, you know, that'll the need for that will follow the instrument. We'll take care of that before we sell it. Yes.
Consignment, how much do you usually charge to get the neck reset before you sell it?
Well, you know what? The prices are kind of overall on each of these operations that we do. It really matters where, like there's such a wide range, like around Martin stuff, you know, about $800 is the starting place kind of just for the neck reset. And then there are other issues. If somebody's already been in there and done some damage, how far it's got to go on Gibson instruments that have wide heels, wide laminated necks, and all of them have their own difficulties. And so the prices are adjusted accordingly because they take much longer. And especially, you know, disassembling guitars, each one is a little different and they take some patience to do right. So that time has to be figured in as well. Well, we use historically what they we use hide glue because that just not only does it work well, even though it's an old world adhesive, but it dries really brittle, which transmits vibrations well. It sounds good as well as
I think that's like one of the things that makes those old guitars so special to a lot of people is the fact that the glue does contribute to the tone.
Absolutely. Of course, I mean, every little last bit of the design of those makes them what they are, and the hide glue is definitely part of it.
So that's cool. So now, as far as the bridge replacement, there's like this misconception that almost every old Martin has had a bridge replacement, but you told me that's not true.
No, that is not true, because if you have the original bridge and you reset the neck, you can set it to that height and make it work just right. However, you know, over the years, you know, the vast majority of those Martins have ebony fingerboards and ebony bridges instead of, you know, some of the war periods when they're using some different woods. And that ebony is just the wood that wants to crack the most out of all of it. You know, if you don't keep that supple, I guess that's something we'll tend to at some point too. Mm-hmm. Is talk about, you know, in maintenance of keeping wood oiled up. Ebony's really the only one that you really need to make sure that it stays kind of hydrated. That's the one that gets brittle.
When you get a guitar in there, can you tell right away if it's the original bridge by just looking at it?
You know what? For the most part, you know, because we've looked at so many of them, we know what the shape is supposed to be. And also, too, there are some dimensions to, like, let's just say, you know, like a war period belly bridge for a Martin. I just happen to know. I mean, I can't regurgitate. I'm not an encyclopedia, you know. I know how things work and are put together as far as everything about it, every attribute of every model. I have all the resources to look it up. But it just so happens, I know that a belly bridge from that era is 320 thousandths deep about at the low E string. And they ran the range from like 270 to 280 thousandths on underneath the treble side of the string. So that's like when you know just a couple of dimensions and you're used to seeing the shape of it, you can pretty much tell if it's right. And ebony looks different now than it used to. And
right,
yeah, we get pretty close on that. Sometimes you can't tell if people sand it on it, because, you know, instead of doing neck set, sometimes people will sand down the bridge, try to get a little more you know, to be able to lower the action some more. And but for the most part, we've just gotten so used to seeing that, you know, that nice super beautiful black tight grained ebony. And once you're used to looking at those shapes of belly bridges and pyramid bridges, you know, although there are some great craftsmen here and in other places that do excellent replicas of those.
Right. I like when I go on the Grooms website to look at the flat tops, most of the Martins, you state right there the bridge has been replaced. And it was kind of like, it's not like anybody really discounts anymore, you know, the fact that it's been a bridge replacement. as long as it was done right.
Right. Now, sometimes, you know, often they're replaced just because once they split down through the peg holes, it's really hard to get that to get glued and get it to stay. Now on more expensive instruments, you know, like maybe a Golden Era D28 or something, you know, that's worth a lot of money. Sometimes I'll take those bridges and I'll do an extra kind of repair. We put carbon fiber inside of it and then cap underneath it with ebony and glue it on that way. Now that's the only way I could get really an original bridge to keep a gluing when it's split like that.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to belly bridges and pyramid bridges, are the belly bridges where most of the problems are, or does pyramid bridges also have quite a few problems?
Oh, it's all across the board. You know, it depends on how those instruments were cared for, if they were abused. I mean, I've seen pristine versions of both of those instruments and destroyed versions of them as well.
Is there anything you could do about the old ivory bridges if they're broken? Nothing, right?
You just fix them.
Fix them.
You just fix them. Epoxy and carbon fiber are your friend in that case as well.
All right, let's talk about the fretboard. Now it's obviously you're going to have to change frets in these things. Can you guys change bar frets?
Yes, we do bar refrets. Now that is its own extra little zone. That the way they used to put bar frets in is a different thing. They would put shims in them to adjust heights. Trying to get those level down, because actually you need bar frets to be quite a bit shorter than standard frets to feel comfortable. Otherwise they feel kind of they feel like your finger catches on them. It's whole nother deal. It's basically pretty much double the cost of a regular fret, but we do have that wire, and you know, and it came in lots of thicknesses, and sometimes they would put different size bar frets in to like compression fret a neck. I mean, it is it really is its own little zone. Mm-hmm.
I know most people, like most luthiers, don't want to even touch the bar frets.
Well, there were so many instruments with bar frets on in the first part of the last century that are collectible that you know, we need to be able to take care of that stuff.
I think like people that don't really understand Martins, they don't understand how structurally important those bar frets are for the strength of that neck.
Oh yeah, since there's no truss rod and sometimes no strengtheners in it, the stiffness of that fingerboard glued on sometimes is the main part of the structure, for sure.
And sometimes when somebody brings in a guitar for consignment and he has a pre 30, I guess it was 31 that they switched to Tang frets, right? So have you ever found where somebody puts Tang frets in where should have been bar frets?
Oh yeah. That quite often, just because, you know, like we said before, throughout the history or the life of the instrument, to many people, it was just a guitar and they're probably just trying to get it functional. Yeah. You know, and, we have that happen. That's a regular, sort of thing, just because not very many people want to go through the or don't quite understand bar frets.
Mm-hmm. Are the necks affected by that? Like that it's obvious there's a problem?
Well, you know what? It doesn't always cause a problem unless for some reason you've done something in each process that makes it so there's not as much stiffness to push against. Like if you, on any one of those fret jobs, if you left the fret slots to the Tang ratio kind of loose, you know, the neck is just going to give back more. So there's a feel to how firmly frets should go in, to whether they're, tangs with barbs or whether they're just the flat part. And, you know, even some of those old bar frets, they used to take a little cutter and crimp the bottom of them to act like a barb of a tang on a standard fret. And they'd use that to do compression fretting, like near where the flex is close to the body. If you see, sometimes we'll pull those bar frets out and somebody will crimp those trying to get the neck to push back a little more. Mm-hmm. So there's a really, you know, when somebody, again, some of these operations, some of them are simplistic, but when somebody just talks about, well, refretting a bar fret or just refretting in general, the number of details that come into that is just often more than you think.
Right. And what should a refret job cost on average for just for somebody who takes it into a luthier to get refretted? What should they expect to pay?
I think a real starting zone, like $500 for just a standard electric guitar refret. And then once you start getting like real wide basses or binding on the neck, you know, a little more, because it takes some more takes a little longer to cut the tangs off and make it nice where it lays over the binding. And once you start getting into like, you know, some of those bass fingerboards that are, because we don't deal with as much high-end modern electric basses here as we do vintage ones. But, you know, 24 frets of a 7-string bass is a whole lot of fret wire.
So I for me, it's like, you know, the refretting is magical. I think as far as maintaining your guitar is not being afraid to refret it. You're no longer taking 10% off the value by refretting it, and it makes it playable. It's a huge component of your tone, having the frets.
Well, you know, it really is. I mean, not having the neck and the frets in the proper condition, you don't know what the instrument is yet, and so that's why it is definitely common modern wisdom people that know understand that the playability and the way the frets are put in and all that is the heart of the guitar.
Right.
And it can't be everything it can be. And so nobody ever questions that anymore.
Okay.
They just don't.
Now let's talk about the one that matters the most to us flat top people, and that's cracks. I think I was telling you on the phone that I was at Grunes about maybe 5-6 years ago, and I got up to the second floor. I didn't get all the way to the third floor where you guys are, but I spent a whole afternoon with George, and I went home with a 31 OM28. Just this winter, it had its first, it cracked right across the front, broke my heart, and it's all my fault. It was all my fault because I kept it out of the case. It was on the wall hanging. And the humidity in Arizona, as you know, is very low. And here I thought I was getting away with stuff. I wasn't. I got bit bad.
Well, you know, it's just, again, it's because there's so few things in our life nowadays that are fragile like that. You know, we have everything made as sturdy and plastic and glass and stuff. And these instruments just aren't. I guess it's just maybe people getting a fundamental understanding of how wood works. And actually, sometimes it's not as much the extremes of temperature and humidity as it is a quick change. Like if it's really dry and then starts to humidify real quick, and one part of the wood is moving faster than another part, that's when the wood has an opportunity to separate. And same with temperature. If, you know, that's why when you ship instruments and you ship them and they're cold, you know, you wait for a while and let them acclimate slowly in the case so that the contraction and the expansion rate is the same for the wood as it is for the finish. So the finish doesn't check. Mm-hmm. And so, as much as you want to keep it in your middle zone, if for some reason you have to operate outside of that zone by humidity or temperature, if you could make the instrument come back to a more ideal temperature and humidity slowly, it's better.
And spruce tops are the worst, right?
They are the bane of the existence. However, maple is not much more forgiving if you have that on your sides and back either. And ebony, old ebony, like, you know, we have so many instruments from the beginning of the last century, most especially like, you know, mandolins and L5s and some of the earlier Martins. That ebony is very fragile, and keeping it, you know, keeping some kind of keeping condition. I mean, we don't slock stuff on them, but any of those standard kind of fretboard conditioners, mm-hmm. you know, Music Nomad makes some, and it, or Lemon Oil, whatever it is. And I would just say the most important one would be ebony.
Ebony.
To keep, kind of keep, you know, supple. so that it won't crack.
Now, if you do crack a pre-war Martin, that's not the end of it, right? You can fix it. You can get it back, right?
Absolutely, it can be fixed. And, you know, I would, it needs to be fixed, because once you get a crack started, the dust around it will get into the edge of the crack and act like a wedge. And so that crack can never, each time that it expands and contracts, it'll open up a little more and a little more. So, but getting that fixed is important, but also getting it fixed at a good place is important, because we see a lot of the not the right way to do it repairs.
So I'm going to get, right now, I trusted Reed Munns is my luthier. He's down in Tucson.
Yeah.
I trusted this guitar to him, and he's still working on it. I'm going to get it back pretty soon. What should I do from this point on? Should I never take it out of the case unless I'm playing it? Like, no more just hanging it on the wall?
Well, you know, you should be cognizant of what conditions it spends most of its time in. You know what I mean? Like, again, if you got to go to the gig and you got to go play, that's your guitar and you got to go do the thing. But then when you're storing it, what condition is it in? I mean, if you're going to keep it hanging on the wall, then maybe you keep that in a room. That's the one you keep humidified.
Right.
You know,
I have a humidifier. I have a humidifier, but it's always out of water because I'm in Phoenix.
I go in there and it's got
the big red light. Now, but I was thinking, so I know that you guys put those packs in, right? Like when you...
Yeah.
Do you recommend those packs? The
You know what? They seem to work really well. And the cool thing about them is they go both directions. You know, they not only do they add humidity when it's dry, they actually, if it gets over humid, they pulls it back the other way too. So yeah, you just have to keep track of them and switch them out when you need to.
And what about the sponge, you know, the ones that have the little sponge in it, you put it in the sound hole?
Well, you know, the only thing about those is for people to realize that if you're doing a sponge thing, it means you got water in there. Don't put too much in it. Mm-hmm. And they're a little bit more inexact on the science part. You know, those humidipacks like the Dario make and some other people, they're made to like give, you know, to suck stuff in over, you know, 50% or so and to give it back under that. And so just like seeing a little more.
How long does that pack last?
You know, I don't know. I don't know, because I am not an acoustic guitar player. And so the acoustic guitars I own stay at the house and don't go anywhere, because nobody wants to hear me do any of that.
Well, you live in Tennessee. You got humidity.
That's right. With or without humidity.
I live in Phoenix. There's no humidity.
They said they don't want to hear any more of that.
So the crack repairs, don't be afraid of them. Get them fixed. Maintain them. If you're smart, you just maintain it. Make sure you got the humidity controls. I know that was my big error. I have all these acoustic guitars that never cracked before, but the Martin, the pre-war Martin, it did, because it's got a really thin spruce top and bit me. And I'm like, well, I learned a lesson.
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, one thing to realize too, that you've got your old instruments and people love them and they're expensive and they're precious about them. You know what? Sometimes they crack. And sometimes, you know, just things happen. It's made out of wood. It's organic. And sometimes it's not like, it's not somebody didn't do something heinous. It was like that little scene decided it was time to give it up, you know? And sometimes that's just the way that is, but there certainly is a lot we can do. And instruments nowadays, their value has started to a little bit, some of them outstrip some of the things that naturally happen to them. Now, you know, like we talked about, needing neck sets, refrets, bridges glued on, bridges replaced, bridge plates is a really big deal that way, because people do want to know if somebody's buggered with the bridge plate, it affects the sound.
Mm-hmm. A bridge plate replacement is a big no-no. You don't want that.
Well, you don't want it unless you need it. Now, if you're in a situation where someone before you has already destroyed that and made it not functional for its purpose, and then you have to do it, then at that point, what you do is, you know, is replacing one the right way according to that instrument and the way they were made. Like, so, you know, so I mean, those old Martins had bridge plates that were tucked under the braces there, and they're not real thick, And, you know, sometimes we make decisions with instruments that need a new bridge plates that have had top damage. We will actually sandwich a sliver of carbon fiber in the middle of a maple bridge plate for a little more structural support. And actually, you would be surprised at how amazing it sounds. Okay. Because carbon fiber transmits vibrations really well.
Okay. What about bracing repairs, internal bracing?
You know, that's all on a case-by-case basis, but it really takes a lot to break a brace. Mostly we just re-glue braces that are loose for the vast majority of the time. And then for braces that are broken, just, you know, making sure that those are that they're secure. Again, along the lines, we're always trying to think of how it was designed. You know, everything is transmitting vibrations, doing its job that way. And that's what we want to interrupt the least. And that will might, because sometimes these golden era instruments, there'll be three, you know, mid-40s D28s, and the one that's worth the most is the one that sounds the best. Mm-hmm. And that one is because, you know, maybe thoughtful decisions were made along the way in its restoration, things that we understood that would contribute to that.
Is X bracing the most susceptible to cracking?
No, every kind of bracing.
So when you get old Gibsons and you get old Martins, which ones do you find need the most bracing work?
There's no brand or kind or model of instruments that, it really has to do with the way they've been cared for. I mean, it's really obvious so many times. You'll have something in the whole interior of the acoustic guitar, you know, is like a bracing maraca, you know, with all of them rattling around in there. And then they'll be the same model. It's been completely cared for and intact. Mm-hmm. So it really is just, these instruments have all had different stories. And so we just try to put them back into a condition where they can, you know, continue to be functional
right. For
somebody else.
Now, I would assume that when it comes to tuner replacement, how often do you have to replace tuners on these old guitars?
Well, now there's a balance in act that that we play between keeping things original and authentic and functional. And often, you know, some of those, especially some of those tuners that have posts that are pressed on, you know, or just held on by squashing the end of the post, you know, against the gear. Mm-hmm. Some of those things will fail and be really difficult to try and repair to make functional. So often what we'll do is, we'll either, if we have it, you know, if somebody asks for it, use a later period appropriate tuner, or just use a repro and put the originals in the case.
Right.
That way then you'll have the originals. They may or may not be functional, but they'll be there, and, you know, make sure whatever kind of reproduction you have has the same footprint for screws and everything that the other one had. You know, there is still a balance, you know, so people still do want to play these instruments, even the really expensive ones. You know, they'll often go to a place where they're being used.
Right.
And so they have to be functional.
Now, the Gibson susceptible to the old, you know, the old buttons sometimes crack and just wither away, right?
Yeah. But we have, we do have replacement buttons for both the little round ones and the tulip style ones, and the green keys that they call them. Yeah, we do. And that's a fairly regular operation we got to do. We just heat, pull the tuners off, and we heat the old ones off and heat up the tuner shaft and put new ones on there the way they were originally put on.
Out of all the tuners that were made in antiquity, are Clusens the best? Like, if your guitar has Clusens, you probably have less problems.
Clusens are probably the most, but, you know, I played instruments with all those old Grovers and Waverleys and things on there. Any of these modern gear tuners that were made then, you know, that weren't the inexpensive ones, function pretty well. But I sure am used to the Clusons. Mm-hmm. And they're the most, probably the most widely used. After you get into, I'm trying to remember when they started, Cluson was like in the dates. When I remember they were on some Martins at the end of the 40s.
Yeah, they had the plastic buttons.
Yeah, and the metal one too. Like there was a single line Cluson that was even on a D28, like in 48, not like that after they switched the binding over.
Should we always be lubricating and cleaning our tuners?
Yeah, you know what? You're not going to hurt a single thing by just maintaining those the way you would any gear. I wouldn't get out. The only thing to watch with people will like put 3-in-1 oil in there. And they'll get it and it'll get all over their headstock. Mm-hmm. And then it'll seep down next to the shaft into the paint around the, you know, just trying to keep it off the guitar. Otherwise, it'll soak in. Then you'll get these black streaks coming out from your tuners. I see it a lot on older instruments that way, from oiling up your tuners and then getting it on the guitar.
Yeah, I don't even bother. I just trust that kind of stuff to somebody else because I don't know, you know. Now, let's talk about refinishing. Now, this out of all the things you can do to a guitar, this is probably the most that knocks the value down the most is refinishing, correct?
Well, basically, we start out when we're considering a value. It'll change as the instrument values go up, like really high, you know, when you start to get into I don't know what, you know, the top end of Burrs and D45 and Explorers and Flying Vs and all that stuff is. But for the vast majority of instruments, once it's refinished in totality, you can just, you're instantly cut in half on value. Just consider that where we're at, then we'll go from there for the rest of it.
And how many times do you encounter some of these old Martins being refinished?
You know what? We're discovering more often than you think. Not just refinished, but you know, finished over again. It was a common occurrence there for a little. People weren't really that. They like to have their instruments like spruced up and refreshed. They used to send stuff back to Gibson and Fender and you know, in the earlier part of the last century, a lot of those, when dealers had those mandolins, mm-hmm. at the early, that were just you know, that were French polished on there, the distributors would send them back once they started spraying nitrocellulose lacquer to be sprayed in lacquer and then put back on the shelf. And so none of the manufacturers or anyone were stranger to adding finish to or refinishing things. And the more tools we have to discern the difference between between the things that are authentic and things that have been redone, the more we're discovering that a lot of instruments have been if not refinished, for sure, oversprayed.
Definitely. And one thing I learned from Larry Wexler is that, like, a lot of the D45s that he's encountered, they were refinished. And that's because the person who's playing it always wanted it to look nice and fresh.
And that's the deal. I mean, you know, but probably a lot of those were refinished at Martin.
You know,
they probably sent them back.
Right.
And so it was probably a very nice refinish. Probably even now probably be able to be analyzed as period correct if it wasn't too far removed from the year it was, you know, originally manufactured. But still, again, back in the day when people just thought these were just guitars.
Yep. I'm, you know, one thing that I've always been kind of confused about, they talk about lacquer. Like today, all the lacquers have plasticine in them, right?
Right. Well, you know, save some. You can, there's a couple brands that have a little less plasticizer stuff in them. But yes, it's a different product for sure. And there's different kinds of lacquers as well as the standard, that solvent-based nitrocellulose. There's also some catalyzed lacquer, you know, that, you know, has an accelerator in it. And mm-hmm. yeah, it's a different animal now and trying to get things that look like and function like old world lacquer gets increasingly a little more difficult.
From your ear, can you tell the difference if somebody has a new lacquer or an old lacquer?
I feel certain that there's no way on earth I'd be able to A/B that in a way to with any kind of accuracy. However, I have heard instruments before and after they had too much finish put on them. And I would tell you that I would think the thickness of the finish would have and the hardness would have as much to do with it affecting it sonically as anything else.
When somebody brings something in, what's the first thing you do to ensure that, that it has not been refinished?
Well, we have a few ways. First of all, it works like a little more like a collective here. You just don't hide in your corner all day. I mean, we all confer. And, you know, I've got a lot of different guys with a lot of different kind of experiences up here, from guys who used to work at Grunes, 25 years ago, to guys that are going out and teching for major artists and stuff. So these guys have so many different things. Somebody up here knows what you want to know. And so we'll come in here and, we have guys that look at more iconic age Martins than other guys. And I'll get with those guys if I have a question about anything, get one more take on it. And then we have a black light room with two different spectrums of light that we use. We're looking to see, unfortunately though, on old refinishes and old repairs, it's not as easy to see the differences in those, even under those black lights. It takes some pretty more high-end analysis to do some of that. And so
this new lacquer, is that because newer lacquer's brown under black light?
Newer lacquer is usually just dark. You can see it as a shadow.
Yeah.
But then new lacquer from, it depends on which era of lacquer. Some of them earlier in the last century, they're yellowy, orangey. It goes yellowy, orangey, green, like blue, like there's a bunch of different looks. But the biggest difference is this, just to see contrast in areas that we suspect have been either oversprayed or refinished, and try to draw a contrast between that and the areas that look like that they haven't been touched.
So now let's kind of push over into the solid body electric guitars. The maintenance on those is not as, it's not as involved, but you still have to maintain them, right?
Absolutely. And I think some of those older instruments, they have little problems that aren't obvious. Mm-hmm. Let's say like 50s and 60s Gibsons once they get to tunematic bridges, people don't understand why that you've got it set up and it doesn't play well. They don't understand that like a tunematic bridge, there's these little sags in the middle over time. And then the radius isn't in there. So the strings in the middle are closer to the neck than the strings on the outside, sort of thing. And there's just so many tiny details like that that are just vintage guitar problems that we try to assess every time that we put one of those on a bench. We understand about functionality of components from different eras. When we're talking about 50s and 60s Gibsons and Fenders, all these single action truss rods, it's a really big deal to test out does that truss rod have any travel of adjustment for that instrument left. Like some, if it's overbowed and you take all the string tension off, it's still overbowed, we have a problem, and that just things like that. On those kind of instruments, you really have to pay attention to neck condition. And we have cures for that stuff, but it's pretty invasive.
Like a heat press, right? You would press it with heat.
Yeah. Sometimes you may have to, there's some things that don't want to respond to that. Like, one piece maple necks from the 50s. You can't really heat move those. Then you have to think of some other choices to make some of those functional. Sometimes Gibson instruments have had to have, there just wasn't enough curve built into the neck when it was made, and they have to have the truss rod rerouted that channel, or the fingerboard pulled and re-glued back on straight. Sometimes heating it up doesn't make any sense because by the time you get it hot enough to move and re-glue itself, you're in danger of burning up the binding.
Right.
Yeah.
One of the things, like Gibson, for example, solid bodies, they have the binding. So when you refret that, how do you not affect the binding on the neck?
Well, there's a couple of ways. I've done it both ways. And nowadays, not very many people will try to put, you know, on the edge of the binding on those bound necks, like those Gibson necks, the binding actually comes up on the edge of the fret, you know, and there's like a little nib of the binding on the end. And when you refret it, you lose that. A couple of times I've done a couple of refrets where you tried to get them exactly in between those as if it was the original fret. And we've just kind of decided in most cases that it's more trouble than it's worth. And actually on some of those old Gibsons, you get a little tiny bit more playing surface by overlapping the end of the fret onto the binding. So what we do, we have a special tool that cuts the tang underneath off, and then you'll take a small file and smooth it.
Right.
So what happens is when you lay that fret into the slot, you're actually laying the ends of the frets on top of the binding at the end, and then it's seating it like that.
We mentioned that you're not going to take a big value cut in refretting vintage instruments, but we will point out that if you use the wrong kind of frets, like if you start putting fats on 50s Fenders, or that does devalue, right?
Well, it does devalue just because, you know, it's not typically what would have come on that instrument, and keeping these things as authentic as possible in all the dimensions of even the, you know, the maintenance style repairs that have been done. And also to be careful along the lines of what I was saying before with these single action truss rods, that it is so easy to put fret wire in a neck and maybe press it in too hard until it pushes back and you have a back bowed neck because you didn't tend to how much pressure they were being pushed in with. And they can back bow your neck by putting frets with too large a tang.
And again, humidity is a big deal, right? Arizona, you got problems with your rosewood necks.
You know what? You have to be cognizant of that all the time.
Now let's talk about Gibsons and neck repairs. Do you find that a lot of Gibsons, because of the angle of the headstock, have to have the neck replaced or the neck headstock repaired?
Yeah, you know what? There's just no way, physics wise that wouldn't have been a problem. I mean, that, you know, mahogany is not like maple and how dense and hard it is. And when those necks are cut in such a way that the grain will go across there at the headstock, they're just going to break. I mean, when they would destroy guitars at Gibson, you can take any Les Paul and just let it fall forward on a piece of concrete and it will break 100% of the time.
Yeah, and that's, people found that out the hard way.
But you know what? It's just the part of the instrument. I mean, it's just not a wash and wear instrument. I mean, if you want something that's more durable than that, then you get something else. But it does what it does. It's just a little more delicate and has to be cared for. We do a lot of headstock repairs and in a lot of different kind of ways, you know, depending on value. Like I did one on a burst, but it was worth doing because it was that by to replace the headstock veneer and put a mahogany veneer on the back of the headstock and have a carbon fiber inside for structure because so much damage had happened.
So there are Gibsons that it's worth playing that neck or fixing that neck if you want to keep playing it.
I'll tell you what, actually, to be honest, it's worth it just because that is the instrument.
Right.
And actually, if you get a bad headstock break and somebody fixes it right, it's basically not going to break again.
For sure.
You know, you'll have, especially somebody, you know, there's a lot of different, like I know Joe Glazer over here close by. He does a great repair that he does with a pin router business where he carves out the exact area to put a carbon fiber mesh on. And so that it ends up at the same level as wood around it. It's a great repair. Man, that you can pull a truck out of a ditch with that thing when you're done.
So most of these neck cracks really happen pre-Norlin, right? Once they change the angle of the headstock, do they still have neck breaks?
Oh, yeah. No, it doesn't matter. Era doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Okay.
These a modern Les Paul is going to break. It just it doesn't that mahogany headstock, the grain going that way, that's just the way that is. It's just more susceptible to breaking.
Have you ever seen a Thunderbird bass that had that didn't have a broken neck?
Just a couple. Actually, I think we have one in the building right now that's really beautiful, like a 64 or something.
And it has it intact, right?
It's intact.
And when somebody asks to play it, you say, no. Don't lean it against anything.
Yeah. Here, sign this way. No, yeah, those are their own beasts to work on.
Yeah. I personally would love to find I'm looking for one of the Sparkle Bursts. Deluxes.
Oh yeah,
from the 75 Deluxe. I'm looking for a specific one, and every single one I found has had neck repairs, or has been routed for the bigger pickup. And I'm like, dang it, but maybe I have to just swallow the bullet and just get one that had a neck repair.
Part of the deal is the chase a little bit too.
Yeah,
you're the hunter looking for that thing.
All right, let's talk about here's one that I get a lot of people ask me about, is about rewinding pickups. Is that not the most righteous thing to do when the pickup fails?
Well, to be honest, you really have no choice. As long as you have somebody rewinding that pickup that understands how it was originally made, using the same kind of wire and the same, same general kind of winding way they used to do it, and you end up with the proper load on that, then it's a good thing. I mean, and it has to be done. If you have a failed coil, you just can't, it's not saleable with the instrument that way.
Right.
And so we're fortunate to have several guys that can do this stuff the right way here at Grooms. And it's a big deal.
How much do you think a rewound pickup devalue? Like if something was going to be sold at Grooms, how much would having rewound pickups lower the value of the vintage instrument?
I'll tell you what, anymore, so many of those instruments have rewound pickups in them. It would probably depend on the context. Like if everything else was pristine on that, but that, then it would be one thing. But if there were other things that were a little less ideal, it probably wouldn't matter. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like it would depend on the instrument, like how what level of excellent it was, as far as how much a detail like that would matter.
So us vintage guitar people, we tell people, if your pickups fail, have them rewound. Don't replace it with another. Well, I guess you can replace it if it's a player vintage, but for vintage, purity,
right,
the righteous thing to do is to have that thing rewound. It's meant to be rewound. The winders today understand how to do it. They'll pot it properly, and it'll be just like new, right? Or just like old, I should say, just like old.
You know what? There are so many capable winders out there. I mean, just the guys I know, here in town that not only do vintage things, but they can do modern things to order, basically, frequency wise. Yeah, the technology is there to do that really well, and it has to be done. You have to have a functional pickup, and if you can get it done, as close to the way they did it back in the day, that is the right thing to do.
Which pickups in your experience need to be rewound the most? Out of all the old vintage pickups that are out there?
Well, I'll tell you what, it's really tough. All those Strats during the 50s that had those, brittle covers on them, mm-hmm. that everybody played right through, like half of the Strats we get, in the middle of the 50s there are.
Right. They call it the Buddy Holly effect. The Buddy Holly.
that's a lot. What's tough is, though, sometimes even in things, all those instruments with PAFs, if they went through a lot of course, a lot of those humbuckers, a lot of those weren't potted.
Yep.
And if they've been through a lot more temperature extremes, sometimes they're microphonic enough that they're not functional. Mm-hmm. Like you can't have any level of gain or anything before they start to interact with the speaker. So every once in a while, I have to consider even like quickly, partially potting one of those, but it changes the tone. So,
right. In your experience, a lot of like late 60s Strats and Tellys probably didn't have potting done at all, right?
Oh, yeah. It's all over the board, too. Plus, when they got in there and they were putting unpotted pickups and 1 meg pots, that had to have been a sound to hold pin you to the back wall.
Yeah, if you found out that the pickup wasn't potted, would you pot it before you sold it at Gruen's?
No, because some of them were traditionally not potted.
Okay, so it just depends on your ears and somebody else's ears saying, let's pot it, let's not pot it. It's fine.
Well, and here's the deal. Actually, we won't represent something. We will not adjust it from its authenticity. Because we won't take actions. Now, we'll make moves to make things functional, but we'll do it in like the way that does the least amount of damage. Like mm-hmm. somebody who has a pickup like that, that's all original, has a problem, you might consider,
okay.
We wouldn't pot it before we put it up if it was traditionally an unpotted pickup.
Now we touched on the Tune-O-Matic bridge. How often do these come in and they're notched? Just, they're just notched from string, years and years of string pressure.
Well, nearly every one of them has something going on. A lot of times they're notched because they started sagging in the middle, and to get the radius back, they didn't know what was going on, that the body of the bridge was sagging in the middle. So they just kept cutting the strings on the edges into the saddles to try to keep the radius the same as the neck. So many of those. That's why we get new saddles and stuff all the time.
So it's not a sin. It's not like you're defeating that Tune-O-Matic by putting new saddles on there.
Oh, not at all. You're making it functional. And conversely, too, all of those things, when they're available, all the original parts go with the instrument, every last one of them. So, and actually, when you do that, if you do have the original parts you're replacing, nobody really complains about pricing mm-hmm. to do that. It doesn't, when it's something that's necessary for functionality and you have the original part, it really is less a part of the conversation.
Do you find that you have to cut new nuts for more electric flat tops, or arch tops, or which guitars need the most nut replacement?
Oh, it's all over the board. It doesn't matter. Most of the time, on Strats and stuff, if we do refrets, we'll keep the original nuts, but those are so shallow that once you shim a nut like that to accommodate a little taller fret, they get a little wobbly. And the whole idea of those is to be connected at the neck. But we replace a lot of nuts also because sometimes when nuts were made originally on the instrument, how close they are to the edge of the fingerboards didn't accommodate whatever wear happened later. And often in the restoration process, we'll have to make a nut that has a little more narrow so that the functionality is the way it should be.
And you cut that yourselves?
Oh, yeah. And that's the other thing. Yeah, nuts we make every from scratch, from bone, because every kind of instrument has a little bit different, way of being. None of the, the prefabricated things aren't really exactly that. And, we try to use materials that look right. And, even some of those, nylon looking nuts that were on Gibsons and stuff, we try to use the same material and have it to be shaped in the same way as it was vintagely, authentic.
Now they call these bone nuts. Are they really made out of bone?
Which ones? Like they're
the originals.
It's real bone. Yeah, it's real bone.
Like what kind of bone?
probably cow bone.
Cow
bone. Yeah, they're not probably. using some critter's item. Yeah, whose bone? Wait a second.
I always, you know, they always say bone. I was like, I wonder what bone. I wonder, yeah, whose bone?
But yeah, there and you know, of course, other instruments have, you know, mother of pearl. You know, like from old mandolins and stuff. There are, you know, nowadays, of course, when we talk about vintage instruments, you know, especially like Vintage Guitar Magazine, you guys have been around so long. We think more of like classic vintage instruments. When we think of that, we think of golden era Martins and 50s and 60s Gibbs. But now a bunch of what we consider modern era instruments are becoming, quote, vintage. Mm-hmm. And so now, including restoration techniques and materials from, like, you know, I was just talking about nuts, and it reminded me that, you know, we got bone and ivory. Of course, we don't make any more ivory nuts and mother of pearl, but then so many modern instruments that are considered vintage now have brass nuts.
Right. Or a whole entire different system. You know, the whole, the Floyd Rose stuff is, you know.
Yeah, like the rise in value of some of those guitars from the 70s, like Deans and Hamers and stuff. You have, guess what? Now we need to know about how to restore those instruments and their materials and historically what was going on with them. So it never stops, you know?
Well, Tony, I think we gave people a good idea now that if you're going to be a vintage guitar collector, you're going to need to always maintain these. I paid a price for not maintaining my flat top the way I should have, but, you know, we do what we do. But there's no sin in keeping these things playing their best and sounding their best, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, as a matter of fact, keeping them maintained and in some of the things that you think are restoration acts are really maintenance.
Right.
I think is important for it to retain its value.
To maintain its value, it has to be playable, has to sound proper. And that means, it does mean that you do have to maintain it.
That's 100%.
For sure.
100%.
And that's one of the things, you know, as I price these things, I now don't knock down huge amounts when people get refrets. You know, I don't think there's a penalty for refretting anymore. I don't think there's a penalty for changing, you know, some things out here and there. If you keep the original, just throw it in the case, throw it in a bag, you put it in the case. You're going to have to change, you know, clean pots, and sometimes you can't clean them anymore. But you keep the originals and it's, you know, it's righteous, right?
That is definitely the way you should think about that. And, you know, constantly checking in with, I'll tell you what, my biggest deal is continuing education. You know, every time I come in contact with somebody to learn something else I don't know, even from my peers here, from Greg, who I speak to regularly, from George, you know, the people that come by all the time. If you're gonna do this and really take care of instruments the right way, just keep learning.
Right.
Because you can never learn it all. That's why it's so cool for me to be here.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything I left out that we left out that you want to just throw in?
You know, I think we touched a lot of good stuff. You know, a little bits and pieces about what it takes to do some of those jobs, along with the fact that I think that those are more maintenance oriented actions than people might think. I think we did good.
So out there, you got that Telecaster sitting on your bed and it can't be played anymore because the frets are all bad. Get it refretted, you know, get it refretted. And if you got that Strat and it's got two dead pickups, get them rewound.
Yeah, you know what? You're going to need to if you want to sell it.
Yep. And humidity. Keep your eye on humidity. That's your enemy. That's my enemy in Phoenix.
Yeah, we've gotten several things actually from out west here very recently that were just bone dry, criminally so.
Yep, and I'd be one of those guys. All right, Tony, I appreciate your time. I know you got to get back to work. I can hear them yelling at you out there. Thanks again, Tony.
All right, thanks so much, Ron.
All right. Hey, everybody. I want to thank you again. This was the first half of the season, first five, and now we're going to do another five a little bit later. I'm going to take a little bit of a break. We'll hope you guys have a wonderful summer, and we'll talk to you again soon. Thank you for listening to Buy That Guitar, presented by Vintage Guitar Magazine. Please support VG for all they do for guitar players like us. Please subscribe, like, share, and comment on this podcast. I'd love to hear from you at ram@vintageguitar.com. See you again next week. Bye-bye.
The official Vintage Guitar Magazine 2025 price guide has partnered with 33 of the top guitar dealers in the industry to provide the most accurate values for thousands of models. This includes electric guitars, acoustic guitars, basses, amplifiers, effects, mandolins, and banjos. Whether your instrument is an investment or simply a piece you enjoy playing, it's always helpful to know what it's worth. If you're checking out a guitar at your local shop and want to know its value before making the purchase, this guide is your go-to source for all the details. Available in both print and digital editions, you can have the guide right at your fingertips no matter where you go.